It's a quiet night in Buenos Aires, Argentina. The sky is gray. A storm is gathering in the distance. Two cars are parked discreetly on the side of the road, about 30 meters apart. Inside, seven men sit in silence. Their eyes are fixed on this bus stop. They work for the Israeli intelligence agency, Mossad, and they have spent years preparing for this exact moment. A bus should pull up any minute now, line 203. It's supposed to carry a man coming home from work. But no one gets off. The men grow tense. What if all those years of planning have been for nothing? All they can do is wait. Two of them get out and pop the hood of the car, pretending to fix the engine. A while later, the next bus rolls in. This time, two passengers get off. A woman and a man. The one they've been waiting for. He's not just anyone. He meticulously planned the murder of 6 million Jews across Europe. He's one of the most wanted war criminals in the Nazi era. His name is Adolf Eichmann. This is the story of the hunt for the architect of the Holocaust. It's a cool day in January 1942. This villa sits right on the edge of Berlin, overlooking a large lake. Today, it'll be the site of an important meeting, a conference joined by 15 high-ranking Nazi officials, all educated men. Eight of them even hold a doctorate. They're here to discuss something Adolf Hitler has been planning for a while now, his so-called final solution to the Jewish question, meaning the genocidal assassination of 11 million Jewish people. The men debate. There are a few minor disagreements, but no one questions the main objective, to systematically deport and exterminate millions of people, right in the heart of Europe. This man is especially committed to the idea, Adolf Eichmann. He organizes the conference, and he'll be the one implementing the ideas formulated at this table. Adolf Eichmann started out as a nobody. He dropped out of middle school, then he dropped out of his mechanic apprenticeship, but he remained determined to climb the social ladder. He saw his opportunity in the early 1930s, when the Nazi Party kept winning elections and eventually gained control of the country. Eichmann started moving up the ranks. In 1932, at 26, he joined the SS, Hitler's private guard and military elite corps. Just before the war broke out, Eichmann took over the Central Office for Jewish Emigration. He became the regime's go-to expert in driving Jews out of public life in Germany. But that conference at the lake is about more than that. The attendees only need about an hour and a half to make a decision. Eichmann puts it down in the official minutes. Jews are to be evacuated to Eastern Europe. Some will be forced to work. The rest, that eventually remains, will require suitable treatment, because it will, without doubt, represent the most resistant part. It consists of a natural selection that could, on its release, become the germ cell of a new Jewish revival. Translation: they will be killed. Eichmann is not the type to get his hands dirty. He'll organize the genocide from behind his desk. He orders the construction of gas chambers and crematoriums. He oversees the logistics of the entire Holocaust across Europe. And eventually, he gives the green light to initiate the final solution. Every time a train is dispatched to one of his death camps, he sends a telegram, to be handled in accordance with instructions for special treatment. In other words, send them to the gas chambers. Eichmann wants to kill with maximum efficiency. He has the cremation process optimized so that each corpse is reduced to just two handfuls of ash. He even sets up belt conveyors to speed up the process of removing the bodies from the ovens. With his help, the Nazis murder 6 million people. The killing finally stops in 1945. Germany has lost the war. Hitler is dead. The Nazi regime collapsed. For Eichmann, the world he helped build is falling apart. His capture will involve a good bit of surveillance and espionage, but in our daily lives, being watched isn't justice, it's just creepy. Incogni shields your personal data from so-called data brokers. These companies collect your info and sell it off to the highest bidder. Your contact details, your job and health record, your education, shopping habits, and political affiliation. Insurers, potential employers, and scammers can get their hands on that data and use it against you. all without your consent. Incogni fights back. It scans the internet for your data, sends out deletion requests on your behalf, and keeps pushing, with regular follow-ups and expanding coverage. It also makes sure data brokers don't sneak your info back into their systems. You can keep track of the progress in a neat dashboard. Head to incogni.com/FernTV and use the code FernTV to get an exclusive discount on a one-year plan. You'll find the link in the description and pinned comment. Remember, no tool can guarantee 100% removal, so be smart with what you share online. Not long after the end of the war, Eichmann is in Austria with his wife and three sons. He leaves his family with his uncle and makes a run for it. He puts on the uniform of a low-ranking German Air Force soldier to avoid attention, calling himself Otto Barth. It's the first of many fake names he'll adopt after the war. Shortly after separating from his family, Allied troops pick him up in Austria. They take him as a prisoner of war. But things in post-war Europe are chaotic. Security around prisoners is often lax. Eichmann escapes and makes his way to the German-Austrian border. But just as he tries to cross it, he's picked up again by patrolling US soldiers. This time, his cover is blown. By a tattoo under his left armpit, it's a large A, indicating his blood type. Many SS men got tattoos like this during the war, to get the right blood in case they were severely injured. But now that ink gives Eichmann away. He can no longer deny that he was with the SS, so he claims he was just a low-ranking nobody, and changes his name again, this time to Otto Eichmann. The Americans buy his story. Instead of being brought before a military court, Eichmann is set to work in a series of POW labor camps across Bavaria. He has to sort food supplies and stack ammo. Conditions aren't bad. He gets enough food, and eventually even cigarettes. But he knows it's just a matter of time before someone finds out who he really is. The Allies are repeatedly questioning prisoners, so Eichmann befriends a nurse who sneaks in some clothes for him, a farmer's outfit and a hunter's cap, to help him blend in once he's out. Then he slips through the barbed wire and disappears. Afterwards, Eichmann scrambles his way across Germany, all the way up to the north. Here he reinvents himself again, now going by the name of Otto Henninger. He starts working as a lumberjack and later becomes a chicken farmer. And for a couple of years, no one suspects a thing. Life is decent, but he misses his wife and kids. And there's this constant, lingering fear of being caught. He needs a real plan, something long-term. One day, he spots something in the paper. A former Nazi comrade is now living in Argentina. The country was one of the last to declare war on Hitler. Many Nazi criminals flee there after the war, and Argentina seems to be taking them in with open arms. An acquaintance helps him get in touch with a former SS man in Hamburg. The man tells him about the so-called rat lines, secret escape routes used by Nazis to get out of Europe, with the help of the Catholic Church. Eichmann makes up his mind. He'll go to Argentina too. So he makes it to Italy, and from there to South America. Fritz Bauer is sitting in his office at Frankfurt. He's a Jewish prosecutor, and he's been through a lot. He used to give fiery speeches defending democracy as a young judge in the 1930s. His uncompromising stance made him a thorn in the Nazis' side. In 1933, they locked him up for his political activism. He spent a few brutal months in a concentration camp. There he received repeated interrogations and beatings. He was banned from the courtroom after getting out. And he only survived the Holocaust because he left the country just in time. Now he's back in Germany, in a place that hunted people like him for years. And he builds a reputation. The lawyer who holds up a mirror to the Germans and their dark past. He insists it's not revenge he seeks, but justice. On paper, West Germany is a democracy again, but the justice system is still crawling with Nazis. Judges, prosecutors, and civil servants. Many of them served in the Third Reich and are still part of a close-knit old boys network. Fritz Bauer is an outsider to this world. Every time he steps out of his office, he is entering enemy territory. But that doesn't stop him. He has two goals. One, help build a democratic justice system that actually deserves its name. Two, bring the criminals of the Nazi era to justice, no matter what it takes. Fritz Bauer becomes what people will call a Nazi hunter. And Eichmann is at the top of his list. Which is why this letter lands in exactly the right hands. The sender is a man in Argentina. He says he knows where Adolf Eichmann is hiding, that his daughter dated Eichmann's son, and that this son was bragging about his father being a big shot in the Third Reich. Eichmann is alleged to live in Buenos Aires. The letter even includes a full address. But there's a problem. If Bauer files an official case soliciting extradition, Eichmann could get wind of it. Ex-Nazis and German authorities have repeatedly tipped off wanted Nazi criminals, and there are entire networks of former SS officers in Argentina too. So Bauer tells almost no one about the letter. Instead, he starts his own secret investigation. Going solo means risking his position and maybe even breaking the law. But he's not willing to let Eichmann get away. So he reaches out to Israel's ambassador to Germany. Many survivors of the Holocaust have fled to Israel. Wouldn't it be a historic achievement if this country caught and tried its very architect? Bauer offers a deal. He'll provide the intel, and Israel will make Eichmann face the music. Israel agrees, and sends a Mossad agent to Argentina. The agent wants to assess the situation first. He heads to the address and sneaks up on Eichmann's alleged home. He's expecting a grand estate, something befitting a former high-ranking Nazi official. Instead, he finds a dirt road leading to a shabby little house. The agent can't picture Adolf Eichmann living there. He heads back home without digging deeper. The Israeli Secret Service starts doubting Fritz Bauer's intel. So Mossad tracks down the man in Argentina who wrote the letter. Turns out he's nearly blind and doesn't even live in Buenos Aires anymore. Mossad is about to pull the plug on the entire mission. But then something strange happens. Within just a few months, three different people reach out to Bauer: Germany's ambassador to Argentina, an official at the Federal Criminal Police Office, and the head of Germany's main agency for investigating war crimes during Nazi rule. All three are saying the same thing. There's no way Eichmann is in Argentina. He's probably somewhere in the Middle East. Bauer knows that something's off. All three of them have a Nazi past. This must be what he has always suspected: the old boys network in action. But he has an idea. In late 1959, Bauer issues a press release claiming that Eichmann is hiding in Kuwait. He's supposedly working for a local sheik, and Germany is about to request his extradition. It's a trap to make Eichmann feel safe. Behind closed doors, Bauer keeps pushing the Israelis to follow the Argentinian lead. Eichmann's capture is in reach. But just as it's about to happen, Israel hesitates. Snatching him without an official extradition request could spark a diplomatic crisis. Israel is a young state and still fighting to earn its place on the world's political stage. But they have a real chance of bringing down a high-profile Nazi criminal. They can't just let it slip away. So the Prime Minister ultimately gives the green light. The mission is a go, but it has to stay secret. Meaning, they'll have to kidnap Eichmann. Mossad investigators track down Eichmann's new whereabouts. Some former neighbors end up tipping off one of their contacts. An agent heads out to Garibaldi Street in San Fernando, a suburb north of Buenos Aires. He secretly snaps some pictures of the house and of the man who lives there. Neighbors say his man is Ricardo Clement. That's the same alias Eichmann used when he first fled to South America, according to Bauer's files. But the agent is still not 100% sure it's really him. The most recent photos they have of Eichmann are from over 15 years ago. But the man is living with a woman and two kids. Their ages match those of Eichmann's wife and sons. The agent also sees them celebrating what looks like a 25th anniversary. That too lines up with the intel they have on Eichmann. Putting it all together, Mossad is convinced this has to be Adolf Eichmann. Seven agents are selected to carry out the abduction. Nearly all of them lost family members in the Holocaust. They'll do whatever it takes to catch him. They know Eichmann works at a Mercedes plant, and that he takes the same bus home every night. Line 203. One of the agents is tasked with grabbing him. He's wearing gloves, but not just because it's cold. The sheer thought of touching the Holocaust architect with his bare hands makes him sick. Now Eichmann walks towards his house. He's getting closer to one of the cars. The agents suspect he might be armed. The man with the gloves addresses Eichmann in Spanish. Then he attacks. The two men fall to the ground and roll into the ditch. Another agent rushes in. Together, they overpower Eichmann, blindfold him, and shove him into the back of their car. The entire operation takes less than a minute. They take him to a safe house and start questioning him. He insists his name is Ricardo Clement. But Fritz Bauer has provided the agents with plenty of intel to uncover his true identity: his height, his head circumference, and most importantly, the SS tattoo indicating his blood type. There's only a scar where the tattoo should be. Everything else checks out. Upon further questioning, the man claims his name is Otto Henninger. That's another alias Eichmann used right after the war. The agents hatch a plan. They know Eichmann is a stickler for detail, so they ask their prisoner about Eichmann's SS numbers, intentionally slipping in an error, 45526. Eichmann can't help but correct them. No, it was 45326. Bingo. Eichmann gives himself away. Now the Mossad agents know for certain they've captured the right guy. Eichmann agrees to stand trial in Israel. The plan is to smuggle him out of the country, so they arrange a special flight with Israel's national airline, El Al. An Israeli delegation will fly to Buenos Aires for Argentina's national anniversary. The agents want to sneak Eichmann onto the plane for the return trip, disguised as a member of the cabin crew. They sedate him and dress him in a uniform. They pretend he's part of the crew and had a bit too much to drink. To sell it, other agents pile into the car with him, also posing as drunk. The guard at the airport laughingly waves them through. Everything goes smoothly. The fake crew members dump Eichmann in a first-class window seat, with a doctor next to him. Then the plane takes off. Once the plane leaves Argentinian airspace, a voice comes over the loudspeaker. Adolf Eichmann is on board this aircraft, and he is en route to stand trial in Israel. After 15 years on the run, the man who helped murder millions will finally be brought to justice. Fritz Bauer is sitting in a restaurant. He's desperately waiting for a contact to bring him news on Eichmann. But the man is running late. He finally bursts through the door half an hour later and blurts out, "Eichmann is in Israel, in custody." Bauer hugs him tight, tears in his eyes. Just hours later, Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion stands in front of the press and announces the mission's success. The Eichmann trial begins 1 year after the abduction in Jerusalem. It's a massive event. Across Israel, people gather around radios to follow the proceedings. International TV crews are taping everything. Chief Prosecutor Gideon Hausner opens with a statement that will go down in history.
"When I stand before you, judges of Israel, in this court to accuse Adolf Eichmann, I do not stand alone. Here with me at this moment stand 6 million prosecutors. But alas, they cannot rise to level the finger of accusation in the direction of the glass dock and cry out, 'J'accuse,' against the man who sits there."
To which Eichmann responds, cold and unfazed,
"Im Sinne der Anklage nicht schuldig."
People in Germany are also following the trial. Many can't believe this slight, bespectacled man played a key role in murdering millions of people. Eichmann downplays his role and claims he was just following orders. But countless documents say otherwise. He meticulously planned the genocidal assassination of the Jewish people. He was so committed to implementing the final solution that he clashed with superiors when they hesitated.
"You are signed on this document. It is your name."
"Es heißt aber oben, auch der Sachbearbeiter hat es diktiert. Und ich habe es unterschrieben, selbstverständlich. Denn das, zu dem ich befohlen war, das musste ich bedauerlicherweise ausführen."
But the most powerful statements come from the survivors, people who lived through the horrors Eichmann helped engineer.
"We were told to kneel, heads down. We were not permitted to lift our heads. Whoever did so would either be shot right through the head or would be beaten. Of course, we saw from the corner of our eyes that people who tried to run away were shot right there.
And on the way, there were corpses lying by the roadside. We saw them with a yellow badge. There was no doubt that they were Jews."
On December 15, 1961, Adolf Eichmann is found guilty on nearly all accounts. He shows no remorse until the very end.
"Meine Schuld ist mein Gehorsam."
Eichmann is executed during the night of May 31st to June 1st, 1962. Fritz Bauer kept on fighting, relentless in his mission to hold Nazi perpetrators accountable. He also brought down former Auschwitz officials. He passed 6 years after the Eichmann trial. Only after his death did the world learn of his crucial role in capturing the key architect of the Holocaust.